Hi, we're going to get started. Try and keep pretty close to schedule. Welcome, and thank you so much for coming out in the weather. I know it's disgusting, but we can promise a really great night. And the New York Public Library's Division of Teaching and Learning is pleased to welcome you here tonight. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedules. We're excited to have you here. We're excited to have Candy Fleming here. Just very excited in general. And we're confident that tonight's workshop will not only be personally enjoyable and interesting, but will leave you with some ideas for your classroom, which is exactly what we hope to do as the Division of Teaching and Learning, is provide that combination of what's interesting personally and what's classroom relevant. I have a few announcements to make before we get started. A word about the red folders that you received. If I did the stuffing correctly, on the left-hand side, your last sheet should be an information sheet that you'll use with Candy at the end of the workshop, and you should also have a couple pieces of loose leaf paper as well as your pen. Okay. There are also some descriptions of our upcoming summer programs. We have some really great ones. I encourage you to read over the descriptions and email me pretty quickly because I think they're going to go fast. The second one, the week-long summer seminar, you would do through the Department of Ed, but you can email me with any questions about that. We have general information about our division in those red folders. We have a list of student-friendly databases, Civil War teaching materials. Everything that's in your red folder is also available on our website, teachandlearn.nypl.org. And all of those digital gallery images are available for free from home or school. There are over 700,000 uploaded images. So have a field day. So for the digital collections, you don't even need a library card, but I strongly encourage you and all of your students to get a library card. And that sort of brings me to the next point of connecting with your local libraries. Go on our website, find the site that's closest to you and your school, and reach out and make a connection. The librarians will be really thrilled to hear from you. Lastly in the folder are some materials related to the library's advocacy campaign. You probably know that the library is facing really dire and incapacitating budget cuts. So we could use your help and your students' help. If you could get your classes to write letters of support and then mail those letters back to me in the envelope that I've included, we included some samples if you wanted to just run them off and give them to your students, or some ideas if you wanted to have your students write their own letters. One thing that's really important is the address, whether you want your students to put in their school address or you want to send it home with them and have them okay it with their parents and put in their home address. But the thing that matters is the elected officials only look at the address for the constituency, so it is important that there's an address in there. I think that's it. I am really pleased to get to say a few words about our guest author. Ms. Fleming won the 2009 Flora Stieglitz Strauss Award for nonfiction for her book, Lincoln's, A Scrapbook Look at Abraham and Mary. The book on the Lincolns also won the 2008 School Library Journal Best Book of the Year Award and the 2008 Booklist Children's Editor's Choice and the 2009 Boston Globe Horn Book Award for nonfiction. Her new book is called The Great and Only Barnum, The Tremendous, Stupendous Life of Showman P.T. Barnum, which won a 2010 Excellence in Nonfiction for Young Adults Award. She's also the author of similarly structured Ben Franklin's Almanac, Being a True Account of the Good Gentleman's Life, and children's stories, including the fabled fourth graders of Aesop Elementary School and Imogene's Last Stand. Ms. Fleming has always thought of herself as a storyteller. Before she could write her name, she could tell a good tale. In fact, she told such good ones that people always thought she was telling the truth, but she wasn't. Between her penchant for stories and her love of language she discovered in second grade, Candy became a prolific child writer. In college, she discovered another passion, history. And she didn't realize it just then, but history is just an extension of storytelling. After all, she points out, some of the best stories are true ones. As a parent, when she begged her sons for more chapters and they just wanted to go to bed, it occurred to her to write children's books. And so Candy became the author we know today. It is the library's pleasure to welcome her and you for an evening of the things she loves and the things we share her love for: stories, musical language, history, and reading. And I'm pleased to turn the evening over to her. Thank you.
Okay.
Now, do I actually have to turn this thing on myself?
It's on.
Oh, it's on. It's on. I'm just thinking about what's wet still, so, yeah. I'm so glad you guys all came out tonight. I wanted to start, and if you have questions, I wanted to be a little informal. So if you have questions, just raise your hand, and I'm happy to answer them. I wanted to start this evening, as you can see, I have two different technologies, so I have to do one at a time. I wanted to start this evening with talking a little bit about my process for writing The Lincolns. So many people ask me why I chose to do The Lincolns. After all, there seem to be so many books about the Lincolns. And I'm a real believer that history is found in small moments, and I'll talk about that more when I talk about my research. But I really believe that history, the kind that we connect to and the kind that young readers connect to, which is my major concern, what do young readers connect to, that those small moments are what they understand because it's so much like you and I. So I'm always searching for things like family recipes, diary entries from when they were teenagers, report cards, pictures of their dog, stories about their pets, favorite meals, that sort of thing, those small moments, dinner table conversations, because history really can be found in those small moments. Why the Lincolns? Well, when I began this project, I thought I was only going to do Abraham Lincoln. And for me, Abraham Lincoln is someone I feel like I know very well. I grew up in central Illinois. I grew up in Charleston, Illinois, actually, which is the site of the Lincoln Log Cabin. When the Lincolns moved from Indiana, they settled in Charleston, and they built a cabin there in 1831, which Abraham Lincoln helped build before he went off on his own adult life and adventures beginning in New Salem. But when I was a kid in the 70s, that log cabin was getting no love from the state of Illinois, kind of like it is now as I have our budget cuts. But back then, no one paid much attention to it. And so it sat out there on a piece of land all by itself about 2 miles out of town. And to this day, I haven't quite figured it out. Some days the padlock was open, and some days the padlock was closed. And when the padlock was actually open, you could pull it off the lock, push the door open, and you could play in the cabin. And so my friends and I, when I was in middle school, would indeed play in the cabin. We would push open the door, and we'd play out there, and there was no one else out there. There were no state park people. There were very few visitors. I don't recall ever seeing another visitor when we were there. And, of course, the days that it was locked, we didn't play. But I can remember wonderful times when we would actually play in the root cellar. We'd climb up to the loft. A couple of times we tried to light a fire in the fireplace. I know, unsuccessfully, luckily. Shoo, could you imagine? And then after we were done playing in the Lincoln cabin, we'd bicycle over another half a mile over to Shiloh Cemetery where his parents were born. And it was one of our favorite places to sit. We'd actually sit against those tombstones of his parents, eat our peanut butter crackers. The courthouse square in Charleston was a site. It was one of the places that Lincoln practiced when he was on the Eighth Circuit, and we would visit there. The fairgrounds was a site of the Lincoln Douglas Museum. My friend Emily, who I spent the night with every Friday night, I think, in junior high. My friend Emily had a bedroom. Lincoln had slept in the home, and he'd actually slept in Emily's bedroom. And so I always said that every Friday night, I grew up sleeping in the Lincoln bedroom. And every Friday night, for a while anyway, it was the 70s, right? We'd get out our Ouija board, and we'd try to call him up, and he never came. But we told people he did. And so for me, he really was like a neighbor. And if you've ever been to central Illinois, it is like no place else on earth. We mark everything. If Lincoln wrestled with a bully, we mark it. If he bought a hat there, we mark it. If he actually, you know, spit there on the sidewalk, we mark it. Seriously. And so for me, he was someone I knew really, really well. Someone that felt more like a neighbor than a historical figure. And it was that familiarity that I had with him, that neighbor feeling, the man that I felt I knew intimately, that I wanted to share with readers. I had not intended to do Mary Lincoln, but as I continued doing my research on Abraham Lincoln, I kept coming across Mary. And I kept finding her in ways in my research that I found was unexpected. For example, I remember coming across a quote, his first birthday that they had after they were married. They were still in the Globe Tavern at this time, and she threw a birthday party for him. And they had very little money at this time, and she still managed to invite a few friends over. She convinced the landlady to bake a cake for him, and she bought a few presents. Unfortunately, I couldn't find what. I looked. And then she gave this wonderful little speech. She said, "I am so glad you have a birthday. I am so grateful to your mother." And I was like, isn't that wonderful? And then I do that, ask that question that always comes to me when I'm writing a biography, that question that sort of changes everything. You run across some little fact, some little piece of history like that, some little moment, and you say to yourself, huh? Really? And it changes the course of everything. Because up to this point, I thought Mary Lincoln was a shrew. She was not someone who'd, you know, particularly been in love with him, that she was an overspender, and she was insane. Those were the stories we'd heard. But that is not the woman that I eventually encountered in my research. So I began to do my research. And I love to show these pictures when I talk to young readers. And I have to ask before I start, I wanted to ask, how many of you guys are elementary school teachers? Okay, is that K-5 in New York? Okay. How many are middle school? Oh, bless your hearts, middle school. How many are high school? Oh, yeah. It's like, and you don't look too tired for high school. That's pretty good. And librarians, not to be forgotten. Ah, yeah, in middle school or junior, yeah. I love to show these, and I show them to high schoolers as well as elementary school students. I love to show the process, and they all go, oh, when I do, because so many have begun writing their own pieces of nonfiction. And I always tell them that our process is exactly the same. It really is. Mine just is longer. And then they say, how long for the Lincolns? And I say, 5 years, and they like look at me. I had a fourth grader say, oh, Mrs. Fleming, that's half my life. They made me feel so great. But I begin to do that research, and I begin by asking a lot of questions. And I begin by asking, I go from the broad to the specific. And I really am interested in those specific questions. So when I get the main trajectory of a person's life, then I began to look for those little things. And I ask a lot of questions, things that I'm really interested in, things that I'm curious about, things like, you know, what did they carry in their pocket? Did they sleep on their back? Do they believe in God? What was their favorite food? You know, when did they have their first kiss, if you can find it? You'd be amazed what you can find in the historical record if you ask the right questions. And so I begin asking lots and lots of questions, and I make lists of those questions. And then I begin keeping track of all those sources. I have an old school approach to collecting. I know. My oldest son keeps saying, there is a program for this. And I say, I know, but I don't know it. I like my old standard. So I actually have index cards, the two sets of index cards. It's what I learned when I was in graduate school 100 years ago. And so I have those note cards. But I also keep track of all direct quotes. I actually keep track of them on pieces of note paper. As simply as this. So I have three places that I keep those. I have one note card where I keep the actual anecdote or story that I found, another place that cites where I found that anecdote, story, quote, and then the third place, of course, is what quote I happen to think I'm going to use within the body of my text. This is what I use to compile those footnotes at the end of the chapters. So if you look at the end of the Lincolns, you'll see that all those are there. I don't use all of them. Of course, I think I'm going to. Then my editor goes, it's way too long. Cut it back. But they go on and on. They go on and on. They do go on and on, don't they? And there they all are. And there they all are. I could have just gone on and on instead of showing you five pages. I could have showed you all of those because there they are, listed by chapters. I love to show this particularly to sophomores. It seems like I go to sophomores and sophomores are all doing their very first research paper and they freak out about the whole MLA. You know, I have to use that format. Yes, you do, I say to them. But I love to show this. And if I go to school in Illinois, that I can actually take these like I'm driving instead of, because you can't possibly get them on a plane. Well, you could, but it would cost you about $70. And so I always take them, you know, I take this photograph. But there it is. All those pages that I just showed you are these right there. And they're by chapter 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. The kids always say, wow, now what are you going to do with it? And they say, I'm going to save them forever and ever. And they go, wow. And recently I showed it to some sophomores and one boy said, do you know, thousands of trees die in the process of your books. Upon which somebody else said, there's a program for that. But I always need to shuffle them. For me. Now, once I've done the research, and for in this case, it was like a 3-year project, the research, before I began writing, before I began to see how this story was going to actually tell itself, because that's sort of what happens. If I do enough research, for me, I begin to see the story begins to reveal itself, how it wants to be told. In the case of Abraham and Mary Lincoln, by the time I got to the third year of research, I knew that it was a dual biography. I knew that she wasn't just going to be part of his life, but that she actually was her own life, and that they needed to be as close to equal parts as they possibly could in the book. And that was only, I only discovered that after I had done enough research to understand that. So, the next step in my process, I love to show it to kids because it's the same as theirs. They're going to look at research. They're going to keep track of where all that information came from. And then they're going to write an outline. I do the same thing. I'm going to take this back. At the same time that I am looking for information, those small stories, those anecdotes, I am also searching for pictures. Visuals, images. I love primary documents. I love photographs of primary documents, and I am always searching. So while I do the research, I am looking for interesting visuals. What I want most when I'm searching for a visual is ones that I think will draw my readers in. I think visuals will lure them in. And so I'm always looking for something that I think will be interesting, that will be enticing. Yes, I'm going to add photographs of things that I think are necessary. If I have a copy of the Gettysburg Address, the one that we think that Lincoln actually had in his pocket the day he gave the speech, I want to put that in. But I also am looking for things that they may not have seen before. This was one of my favorite finds. I think one of my best finds actually came from a private collector. And it's Lincoln's boots. He actually had, and this is what I'm talking about, those small moments, that little bit of research that lures people in, that connects readers, I hope, with this historical subject, makes them come alive. I found this. Lincoln had a lot of problems with his feet. He had big feet. He could never find boots that fit. His feet were always sore. And so he discovered a great bootmaker heard of a great bootmaker, and actually stood on a piece of butcher paper and drew around his feet. So this is his. He's drawn around his feet and he's taken the measurements so he could send them off to the bootmaker. By the way, the bootmaker was so wonderful that the president actually gave him an endorsement for his advertisements while he was still in office. The best boots I've ever had, Abraham Lincoln. Isn't that great? And so 21st century when you think about it. But these are the sorts of things that I want to put into that book. And so all of the time that I'm searching for information, I always have an eye open for photographs. New York Public Library is a wonderful place to find those photographs. So if, say you find a really great story about the Lincoln's dog, Fido, which I did. I found a lot of wonderful little stories about the Lincoln's pet, Fido. Then I went searching for a picture. And sure enough, They actually have one. They had a couple of poses. I liked this one best because he's looking into the camera. As my editor said, we can see his eyes. We can see his eyes. But one hopes that when my readers flip through that book, that this is something that they'll be interested in. They'll see a picture of a dog, read the entry underneath. This too. Mary Lincoln in a spirit photo. She actually believed to the end of her life that this was a photograph of Abraham Lincoln's spirit, showing that he was hovering around to the end of her days, taking care of him. We, of course, know that this is not really Abraham Lincoln's spirit. But this was a time in American history where people believed this. And I've discovered that when kids write me, this seems to be the picture they like the most. So, ghost stories. And isn't that, see, once you know, you need to think about it. You know your reader, and you go, they love the ghost stories. So let's find a ghost. Put it in there. And so, once again, just like I had all those sources, I keep lists of where all of those photographs come from. I always remind, when I'm working with kids, I always remind them that one must always attribute their photographs. So I keep track of mine. And I think in the Lincolns, there's something like 120 photos. Now, I've done all that research. I can now do an outline. And as you can see, even though I do an outline and I have a sense of where things are going to go, you know, as you begin to see how pieces of your information fit together, how can you turn this into a story? I fit it together, but I always tell kids it's not set in stone, obviously. As I continue to write the book, I go back, I reconfigure, I change chapters, I change chapter titles, I write in the margins to remind myself to add something that I may have recently discovered changes. So it's a pretty fluid, the outline for me. And it goes on and on. 5 years. I just said 5 years of research, or 3 years of research. And then I begin the laying out process. Oftentimes, when I talk to people and they look at a book like The Lincolns, they think that I just turned in some photographs, I turned in some text, and some designer laid it all out. And I so wish that was true. But it's not. I'm the only one that can actually tell where all those pieces fit, what photograph goes with what story, what order they go in. And I consider that order very carefully. My hope, of course, with that particular style of telling is there is a narrative arc. So if you begin at the beginning and read to the end, there is a narrative arc to the story, but you don't have to. So the readers can actually read an entry from chapter 6, flip to chapter 1, read an entry from chapter 1, and by doing each individual entry, they are gathering bits and pieces of Lincolns so that they get a story here and they get a story here. They can put that evidence together and discover for themselves. But in that way, they're working just like historians, taking bits and pieces of evidence, putting them together, and drawing their own conclusions about who the Lincolns were. I love that they do that. But I also would love that they read it beginning to end. It can be done either way. Because of this unique approach, however, I'm the only one that can lay it out. Again, one of my sons said, there's a program for this. And I said, I'm aware, but I prefer it this way. So I actually will lay out a chapter. Actually, I'll make a little map just like this. Again, it's very fluid. It moves around a lot. But it gives me a general idea of where my information, how my story is going to be laid out. So once I've done it in my head, then I begin the writing process. As you can see, some entries go pretty well. The writing goes pretty quickly. Some a little harder. Some really doesn't come quickly at all. For the most part, for me, usually I write it 3-4 times. I've gone through the book 3-4 times before I send it to an editor, to my editor, who happens to be Ann Schwartz over at Random House. And then, after I've written it, I actually lay it out. I mock it up. So you saw the map, the layup, but now I've mocked it up. So I'm actually going to use... Again, there is a program for this, I know. But I actually use my copy machine, a glue stick, and a pair of scissors. And what is that, the A4 paper, A3? I lay it out on those sheets of paper. And for me, I actually need that tactile experience. I actually need to move the pieces around so I can see how it looks and how it feels. It's hard for me to describe that, but I actually have to move that around. And so these are my beautiful mock-ups. And as you can see, I'm already reminding myself where each one of those photographs came from, with my catalog numbers and that sort of thing, and what phone number to call so that I can make sure I get it. And I will do this for all 150, 200 pages, whatever it is. And think about that mess that my editor gets. So she gets a stack of manuscript pages and a stack of pages that looks like this. And lo and behold, she actually manages to decipher it. I think that's a stunning thing. So she'll decipher it. And so I sent the first round to her. And she said, here's promised is the brilliant, insightful, fascinating, and long Lincoln manuscript back to you for cutting. I had originally sent her a manuscript that was about 320 pages long, I think. And everyone knows that I'm not going to get a seventh grader to read 320 pages. Yeah. I'm also not going to get a publisher to publish 320 pages, not with all those photographs. We actually considered publishing in two volumes, very historical. It's something that Lincoln history has always done, you know, the multi-volumed Lincoln, Life of Lincoln. And then we thought librarians would probably want to pull our hair out. Because can you imagine publishing the first volume to 1840 and then from 1840 to, yeah, what would you do with it, right? Yeah. So we ended up cutting. Well, I ended up cutting. She wanted about a third cut out. And I have to tell you, it was so hard for me because I already felt like I'd cut half of all the information that I'd found. And I was having a really difficult time deciding what it was I wanted to keep, what it was I didn't want to keep. And so, honestly, the first round here of cutting, I decided that I thought I could cut the Civil War. Really. I don't love war anyway, and I was far more interested in like Mary Lincoln's recipes for chicken and noodles than I was, yeah, the Battle of Gettysburg. And so I kind of tried to trim it back. And I did. I managed to cut it by a third, and I sent it back to her. And she had a few other suggestions, but mostly it was cutting. I sent it back to her a few months later in September, and she wrote, "Dear Candy, phew, I've just finished reading your manuscript. You've brought it all to life, blah, blah." I say blah, blah because this is what my editor does. She writes me something really nice in the first couple sentences. And then you get, then whammy. Here it comes. Yeah, she comes in for the kill. And you can see it coming. But of course, this letter can't just be filled with praise. Now it's time to roll up your sleeves and listen to the suggestions. Here they come now. And then she goes on. For, you know, one page, two pages, three pages, four pages. And she signs it Love Ann, which is supposed to make me feel really good. But it doesn't, you know. I'm sorry? By a third. Oh, that would have been so great. I'd have cut the suggestions by a third. And these, isn't that great? I wish I'd thought of it. I'm going to remember that for next time because my guess is I'm going to get the same thing again. What I love about it is her suggestions. You know, I love to tell this to high schoolers or middle schoolers or elementary schools because, you know, you talk about revision, rewriting and revision, and they think it's about putting a period in the right place or you fixed your comma or you spelled cat right on page 12 and that's it. You know, it's about mistake as opposed to really reconsidering the material. And so I love the comments that she, I mean, here are her comments, you know, here just on chapter 5. How about adding a biography of Robert E. Lee and his relationship to either Lincoln? I think that's a book. But she wants it squeezed in somehow. Or a bio of Frederick Douglass. Wait, yeah. And his relationship to either Lincoln. Here, let me get a third volume. And Sharpsburg, of course, I kept forgetting all about those Civil War battles. I actually had to add them in this time. But those are the sorts of things that she wants me to reconsider. And honestly, we will battle about what should go and what should stay. I don't always see eye to eye. And sometimes she relents, and other times she convinces me. But for the most part, I hate to say, she's pretty right. And so this means, of course, that I get another round of rewriting, which I did. Rewrote again. And I sent it to her again. So March, September to March, it didn't take too long, 6 months. And then you get this, you're almost done. And you've done a phenomenal job. And you'll see from my scribbles, there's not much left for you to do. And then, of course, she has a few more suggestions. And love, Anne. But they're starting to come together. And by this time, we know that my job is pretty close to done, that we think we've edited it. We think we've got it just about the way that we want it. Random House, especially Schwartz Wade books, is exceptional, I think, in the fact that they never take my word for it. Now, they have all my source material, all that you saw. They have all that source material. They have all those photographs. They have all that text. And then they know I've done all that research. But they still always, always send it to a vetter. They always have it vetted by a scholar, a real-life historian. And all that source material and the text and the photo and that messy layout all goes to a fact checker, a guy who really knows what he's doing. And I say guy because in this case it was a Dr. Harold Lasky. And he had a few more suggestions and comments for me. Nothing too big, but it was things that he thought we needed to reconsider. So of course, one more time, I get to go through that text. Now we're done. That finally goes to the designer. Do you remember those ugly pages I showed you? My mocked-up pages with my glue stick and my, yeah. Same pages, same photographs, same entries. So much better, isn't it? Aren't you so glad there are designers in the world? Otherwise, all those books would have looked like that one I just showed you. So it goes to the designer, and by this time we know that, you know, the interiors are coming. This book is almost done. More pages inside. So much better than my own. And then the cover. It's a little bit different from the cover that you have. Once again, we settled on a different picture of Abraham Lincoln very late in the process because that one, honestly, take a look at him. I think he looks creepy there. Yeah, doesn't it look? It looks a little creepy. And so we settled on a more handsome picture of Abraham Lincoln. I love to tell this story because oftentimes I talk to young readers, they say, when do you title? And especially elementary school, they want to put the title on first, right? And I always say, hold off, because you never know what's going to change, you know, what's going to change. You may end up writing to a title, but instead of your story, you may not listen to the story, you may try to write to the title, or after you've written your stories, the title may not work. For me, titling is extremely difficult because I title last. By the time I've gotten to the title, I'm done. I've said everything I want to say. There is no more for me. And so with the Lincolns, I had originally wanted to call the book The Long and Short of It, because that's what Abraham Lincoln actually referred to himself and Mary as, because he was so tall and she was so short. And so he called The Long and Short of It, which I thought was really clever. But everyone, and I would agree, the kids aren't going to get it, unless I actually spelled it out on the cover, right? So then as I got through the process, I began to think how great it would be, because I'm trying to get kids to read history, how great it would be if we did like a purple cover with spangly letters, right? Wouldn't that be so great? And I thought it was so great. You know, it is a love story. So you can make it look that way. And I had the perfect title for this book. I was calling it Abe and his babe. And if you've looked at YA books lately, the covers, you always have like half a face of a girl, or oftentimes they're like rising from the water, you know, naked back. They thought you could do Mary Lincoln rising from, well, maybe not Mary Lincoln, but, and you could call it Abe and his babe. And I thought Random House just didn't want to do it. So we settled on the Lincolns, which I think works, but we all still refer to it as Abe and his babe at home. So, do you have any questions about the process? Anything? Yes. Always. I do the permissions. Yeah, I do the permissions. For the most part, it's not too difficult. Tracking down some of them, for instance, the one with the boots, that was a private collector, and so I really had to search him out. But even the private collectors are really good about giving you things if they know what it's for. And I have no problem saying to them, it's for the kids, you know, because permissions can get very expensive, especially if you go somewhere like Corbis. You know, they're outrageously expensive. So oftentimes I go around saying it's for the kids. And, you know, you do have a really minimal budget still in children's publishing for a lot of those books. And it's amazing what people will give you if they know that you're serious about your presentation and that you're going to, you know, the photo is going to remain, you're going to keep its integrity. You're not going to do anything to it. And so I'm amazed what people will give you. They'll give you a lot. So. Oh, just to send to my editor so she could see. Oh, yeah. And, well, in this case, because I knew I was doing it, I'd already had the contract before I wrote it. But if I was doing it today without a publisher yet and I was going to submit this to a publisher, I would make copies. And, you know, if you had to mock it up the way I did, I would do that too, with the understanding that you would have to get those permissions. And I would tell them where each one of those photographs was, but I don't think you need the permission to show them that this is the kind of photograph that they could include in the book, because you're not publishing it at this point. Yeah. Leaving out, oh, the third of them? It broke my heart. Yeah. Yeah, and somebody recently, you know, it broke my heart, but, you know, it's so funny. It's like, it's amazing how quickly you can jettison things. Really. Somebody asked me recently, well, what stories did you leave behind? And I thought, I can't remember. Isn't that funny? I can't remember. And it bothered me. And so later, hours later, all of a sudden, I was reminded of stories that I had jettisoned and thought, oh my goodness, how could I possibly? You know, sometimes I think about if you could put it in a picture book. Some of it is so wonderfully anecdotal, perfect little stories. I think one of my favorite stories I ever ran across for Lincoln was he was in Kentucky. I was really searching for stories about Lincoln that would connect to my readers. So I was really looking for childhood stories that we hadn't heard. You know, the story beyond Lincoln reading by the fireplace. Blah, blah. You know, I roll my eyes at it. Yeah, we know he did it. But tell me something new. And so I was searching for teen stories about Lincoln. And one of my favorite stories I found out about him was that when he was still living in Indiana, they would have get-togethers. The kids would get together, and they would have dances. And the girls in this community never wanted Abraham Lincoln to come to the dances. And I thought, why? Was he a bad dancer? Didn't they think he was cute? What? No. He was such a good storyteller. And he would not only tell stories, he'd stand on his hands and walk on his hands. And all the boys would hang out around him, listening to his stories and watching his tricks, and they wouldn't dance. So he was competition. And I loved that. And I thought, oh, my teenage boys are going to love that. And originally I cut it when I cut the thirds. And even my editor said, you know, you got to put that one, you have to put that one back. But, I mean, that's just was a whole, I got a whole new view of him. You know, we just don't want him there because none of the boys will dance with us then. Yeah, too much competition. Anything else?
Was he a good dancer?
No. No, according to Mary Todd, he was not. When they met, he danced. He said, he came up to her. Her story is he came up and said, what was the quote? Miss Todd, I want to dance with you in the worst way. And then Mary said, and he proceeded. He did. Yeah. So, not a good dancer, but what a way. I want to dance with you in the worst way. So, smart woman that saw something beyond that diamond in the rough.
So, some of the things I've read is that Mary Todd really lost it after he was killed, and that there were some mental health things and all of that. How do you treat things like that?
I did. I dealt with it because the last chapter really is Mary Lincoln on her own. After Lincoln, which I think is an interesting chapter because kids tell me, and adults as well, but kids particularly are like, wow, you know, I never knew what happened to the family. He dies and they sort of, we leave the story. We always follow Lincoln, we never follow Mary is you know, sort of the point of the story. She did have some problems, but they were not as severe as history up to this point is always led you to believe. I know that, you know, the favorite story is, they put her away in an insane asylum, so she must have been crazy. Not really necessarily so. In the 1800s, women were put away by their men. Remember, they didn't have any legal rights in those times. They were put away by men for all kinds of reasons, especially in the state of Illinois, was notorious for that. At the same time, there was a famous case of a pastor who was a Presbyterian, and his wife decided that she was Methodist, and so he put her away. Surely she was insane. They suddenly decided she was a Methodist, and so it was a convenient way to get rid of women. And in the case of Robert Todd, he really did want to get rid of her. She was an embarrassment, and she was vocal and opinionated, and she did things that were publicly embarrassing, and she wasn't quiet and meek like women were supposed to be, and that was always a problem for Mary from childhood on, was that she was largely misunderstood because she wasn't particularly quiet and meek. Hard to be, I think. It would be a hard life. And this is a woman that actually had the equivalent of a master's degree. When she stood in the White House, she was frequently the most highly educated, formally educated person in the room. Yet she was expected to be very quiet and have no opinions, which, of course, she didn't do. So this, you know, the story is he put her away. And you can actually read about it in the book. It's a fascinating story because later on everyone agreed it was sort of a kangaroo trial. I mean, they literally came to her house, said, you're going to court now. You have an insanity trial. Oh, by the way, we've given you your attorney who didn't do any defending. They sent her to a place in Batavia, which, by the way, is by the house where it's a town very close to where I live now, Batavia, Illinois. And the asylum is still there, except it's been turned into apartments. And so when I was working, I know it. And so when I'm working on the book, I go searching for this house. It was so much fun, this apartment building. And it has not changed, except it's been split into apartments. And I knew which rooms were her rooms. So I'm standing there and going, that's her room. So I actually managed to get in. I actually just knocked on this lady's door, and a lovely senior citizen actually bought my story and let me in. And afterwards, I thought, you know, I feel like I should tell her, no, don't do that. You know, but I said, oh, this used to be Mary Todd Lincoln's, you know, Mary Lincoln's room. But it was great because I could actually stand and look out. So I got a sense of what it was like. She was only there 3 months, and it wasn't because she was cured. She actually felt that she had been wronged. And so she managed to find herself an attorney, a female attorney in the state of Illinois, managed to get herself out in less than 3 months. And then she moved to Europe because her fear was that if he could do it once, he could do it again. And so she lived those last few years until she became very ill. She actually lived in Europe. So, yes?
Do you find that if you come across a favorite myth, that maybe you find facts that contradict the myth? And then how do you handle that in your life?
I will often say, this is the story that you're familiar with. These are the facts that historians have gathered and put both stories in there. And oftentimes, you know, if we're reconsidering a piece of history, if we're reconsidering a portion of history, sometimes we're not definite yet, but I'll put the debate in. I will actually do that. And when I work with young writers on this same thing, they'll come up with a couple of different facts. I actually say use that. You don't have to settle on one. If you have several facts from a good source, several different good sources, put them both in, you know, or write a historian and ask them, what's the recent scholarship on this? Ask an expert, because they will always answer, especially if they're the lover of Lincoln. They'll always answer. The Ann Rutledge story is being reconsidered again when I was doing my research. You know, we had Ann Rutledge, was the only, you know, woman he ever loved, and then they reconsidered it and said, well, he probably never even had a relationship with him. Herndon made it all up. And now historians are reconsidering again and saying, well, he probably did have a relationship with Ann. We know it wasn't the only woman he ever loved, but he probably did have some relationship with her. So now it's being reconsidered again. And so I think I put up all three versions. I pretty much told you the history of the Ann Rutledge story. Yeah. Does that make sense? Yeah.
You took on this daunting project to write this book, which I will read and enjoy.
Oh, good.
You consider yourself a researcher first or a writer? Does the book come together? Are you doing all your research first and then writing it to make your outline? Or is it kind of a...
I don't write until I do a lot of research, because for me, and I tell this when I work with kids too, until you have all the facts, you can't really write it. And once you have the information, it really does inform how you choose to tell that story. And so I need the facts. Now, I can also say that while I do my research, I am definitely doing research with an eye as a writer. I always know who my audience is. I never forget that in my case, my audience are young readers. And I really think with the Lincolns, it's middle grade, high school. And so when I do go about my research, there's things that I know my middle grade high schoolers are going to be more interested in than if I was writing for the adult audience. So I focus more on the childhood. I focus more on, you know, teenage years if I possibly can. First dates, pets, antics of like the Lincoln children, because what I'm trying to do is connect with my reader. Yeah. So even when I do the research, my eye is definitely on who I'm going to write this story for. Anything else?
I have very silly questions.
No, there are no silly questions. Wait, teachers taught me this. There are no silly questions.
The dog Fido that they didn't take with them to the mm-hmm. Was the Fido just a famous name, or did the name for a dog named Fido become famous because it was the Lincoln's dog?
Fido, I guess, was a common name back then for dogs, and he was a mutt. He appeared, and they named him Fido with the understanding that they weren't keeping him, and I don't think they thought he'd stick around, but he had it good at the Lincoln's. He's the only one that could actually get on that horsehair sofa in the front parlor. The kids weren't allowed to sit on it. Only company and the dog. And he came and ate at the dinner table. I mean, people just didn't do that with their dogs. I love that. And then they didn't take him to Washington, but they wanted when they got to the White House, then they didn't take the dog, but then they had goats and everything at the White House. Goats that actually were in the kids' beds. I mean, it was wonderful and crazy. It must have been a great White House, you know? Yeah. Yeah. Don't you love that? Nanny and Nanko, they were. And you know, one of them I think is so funny because I think I, as a parent, I can guess what happened to them because they would sleep in the bed. Tad rode them, hitched up a chair one time, rode the little goats through a reception that his mom was having in the East Room, while the fancy ladies with their teacups and everything, and he rode through, hey, get out of my way there, with his goats. Then the ladies all screamed, I love that. And they would sleep in the bed. And then Tad and his mother went to New York, and Lincoln wrote to his son and said, oh, I don't know where Nanny, poor Nanny, we don't know where she's gone. Last we saw, she was standing in the middle of your bed, and now we can't find her. And I thought, yeah, I know, that goat went to somebody's house or to the butcher. No, no. Anything else? Maybe, yeah, yeah, and I don't, well, they maybe were intentional about that. The cover, that really was, you know, wasn't, I didn't have much to do with it. Even the fact that, you know, I didn't even really get to title it because my title's not there. But, yeah, the only thing that, like, I remember when it came back, I said, ooh, he's creepy, and I went, ooh, he does look creepy. And we didn't want him to look creepy, so we changed it. But, you know, it might be, it might be. It has. It's had like a crossover appeal. Yeah, and what we've discovered is that adults like to read it because it's shorter, and they have less time, and so it's shorter. And because, you know, it's not written on a lower level. I mean, you know, what does the average American read on the seventh grade level anyway? Something like that. And so, you know, it's not any lower level. So, yeah, it's appealing. I think it's appealing to adults as well. Who doesn't like pictures anyway, Dana?
Two things. One, I think also it's the font. It's very easy to read.
Right.
It's very friendly.
Right. The font is really good, and it changes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I have to ask this. I know it's not ridiculous, but is this book out, Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter now?
Yeah, Abraham Lincoln Vampire Slayer. Yeah.
Yes.
Have you read it? No vampires, but I wish I had. I could be a rich woman today if I had discovered vampires. Yeah, no, I don't. I'm not. No,
no.
Then again, you know, no, no. I mean, maybe his political opponents might have called him a vampire or something, but no, I did it. But you know, have you? Nobody's read it.
Not yet.
Didn't get great reviews.
No. But it's got a great title. And I wish I'd thought of that for my title. Wow, could you? All those high school girls would have been reading it. I wanted to do this really quick. I have the In Your Net Red notebook. And I don't know, does anybody know what the time is? I'm going to actually skip. Five, okay. See, I can see my time is up there now. I wanted to go with this really quick. How many of you guys are actually working with young writers who are working with facts that are, and writing wonderful reports and okay. And I've been doing a lot of this lately. And I've been doing a lot with junior high, particularly junior high and high school, but elementary school as well. And so what I've given you in your notebook, what I've given you is this sheet of facts about Mary Todd's education. And it's just a little slice of history. And when I talk to kids, this is exactly the kind of thing I want them to research. Instead of asking them to give me a report about Mary Lincoln, because what do you get? An encyclopedia. You get a list of facts. Nobody really thinks about it. Nobody presents it. I mean, you know, they don't present it interestingly because they've got a list of facts. So what I've discovered is that if they do just a slice, that seems to make all the difference and makes for more relevant research. It makes for more in-depth research, and it makes for better writing. So what I ask them to do is just a slice. So if they say, I'm going to do Mary Lincoln's life, I say, no, do her childhood education, or no, do her period of time where she was incarcerated in the insane asylum? Or do her life, we just did it, I've drawn a blank, do her life as her shopping in the White House, just her shopping in the White House. And it's amazing how many interesting tidbits, how many great true stories they will come up to with. And I always say, do those five, the who, what, where, when, right? And then, of course, you ask for that supporting evidence. So what I have here are the basic facts of Mary Lincoln's education. We have the where, which is the Shelby Female Academy, located two blocks from her family's Lexington, Kentucky mansion. And I actually ask my young writers to do this, write where, and then as many details as they possibly can. So if they say, oh, Female Shelby Academy, I'll say, what city was that in? You know, go a little farther. Where was that in relation? Did she walk? Did she take a bus? They always laugh. A bus? Huh, don't you know there are no buses back then? Huh. Or one kid said, were there buses back then? That's my favorite. Were there? When she began school in 1827, when she was 8 years old, and she remained there for 6 years. Who? Her teacher's name was Reverend John Ward. What she studied, philosophy, French, geography, composition, literature. How, by all accounts, she was an exceptional student. And then I asked them for supporting evidence, the show me. And it's just like when you write fiction, you know, you have that rule, show, don't tell. Nonfiction really is a story. You're using all those elements of fiction to write a good piece of nonfiction. So you want to show me a good student. You don't want to just tell me she's a good student. And so when I ask for supporting evidence, the supporting evidence means I want some anecdotal stories. I want something that her brother said, or her mother said, or her father said that shows me she's a good student, what kind of student she was. And so in this case, here's your supporting evidence. She loved learning. This is a quote from Ann Todd, Mary's youngest sister. She was far in advance of the other girls and grasped and understood subjects thoroughly, which is what her cousin Elizabeth Humphrey said. At home each evening, she pored over schoolwork by candlelight, which is what Mary's older brother George Todd said. And then her father told a story about Mary's love for Reverend Ward's early morning summer classes. When she was 14, she went to school before daybreak, and the watchman thought she was eloping. He followed her to class, and then he embarrassed himself when he burst into the middle of poetry class. He later admitted that he believed, and this was his quote, only love could make a girl move so fast. Is that great? And then I'll ask my young writer, okay, so here's your facts. Here's your evidence. Here's what you're going to use to build a story. A true story about Mary Lincoln's life as a student, how she was as a student. What's the most interesting fact here? What's the most interesting piece of information? That she was so educated. And if you were going to build a story, what would you show? How would you show that she was so educated because she was so eager, right? Then what?
I said she loved learning.
Yeah, she loved learning. What would you build? What would you build if you're going to tell a story and you're going to use that fiction, that old fiction? Show, don't tell. So don't just tell me Mary Lincoln loved learning. How are you going to show me that she loved it?
The last quote.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And so I will ask students to take facts just like this and create a story. And as they create that story, they're going to think about how much is fiction. I mean, they're going to use their, let me start again. They're going to think about how far that they can actually infer and not cross the line between fiction and nonfiction. Are you following?
Yeah.
Okay, because we're going to try it now. And I get to write on the cool smart board, which I've never done before, so don't laugh when I mess up. I would, but I think you took my... Oh, no, here it is. You were hiding it from me. Okay. So, I'm going to put this here. So where would you start? And think about it in terms of a story. And you know what? I'm even going to help you out a little bit here. Because when I talk with elementary school students, I use, well, okay, pretend you're second graders. I tell them this is my super secret splendiferous formula for coming up with a story. It works for fiction, but it also works for nonfiction, particularly if we're talking about a biographical subject. However, if they were even writing a report about a rock, it would work. Because it shows, it's a perfect example of how fiction and nonfiction really are one and the same. And this is my, oh wait, I have to touch my, oh, let's be red today. Okay. This is my secret formula. There it is. Every single letter in my secret formula stands for something every story has to have if it's about a person. C, of course, stands for character. All stories, fiction and non, are about someone. L stands for location. All stories, fiction or non, take place somewhere. A stands for action. What is your character doing in that story in that place when your story first begins? And then, of course, some problem happens. If you're going to make a piece of compelling nonfiction, there is always a problem. And then what does that person do to solve it? It works really well for fiction, and it works really well for nonfiction. So you could fill it out. Your character, of course, is, I have to touch the red again. Okay, is Mary Lincoln. Or I guess she's Mary Todd, sorry. The location is Lexington. And what year? If you're going to start with if you're going to start with that elopement story, 1826. Right. Let me see. She was in 1827. She was 8. So how old will she be in 8? How old? What year would it be when she was 4? 18. We don't have any math teachers in here, do we? Okay, 1833. And that's important. It's really important when I'm talking with young people when it's 1833. How many times? I love doing this as well because it also shows you where your research gap is. A lot of times I discover that my young writers will be writing about a time in 1833 and they don't quite understand what was going on in 1833. What did people look like? What did they wear? What did Lexington look like in 1833? And you send them back. Go and look. And the beauty of the internet is that we can actually find, you know, engravings of Lexington in 1833 sketches. Action. Mary Todd, Lexington, 1833. What is she doing, according to the information that you have? Okay. So she's running to school. The problem? I'm sorry? Okay, and who was it that thought she was eloping? Okay, so the watchman is the problem. Do you see how amazing this is? When I do this with kids, they break it down and then they actually begin to see where their nonfiction story is. Because history really is a story, and it's about people. So they could tell me that Mary Lincoln was a really good student and she loved philosophy and she studied with John Ward for however many years. Or they can tell me a really interesting story. Which will I remember as a reader? The story. Which do they remember as a writer? The story. And then the solution, of course, will be that he discovers it's poetry class in this case, right? So I'm just going to put... Okay. So having broken down their story, I love this. Really, my handwriting's better than this. Having done this, they are able to see what the core of that story is. Now I'll ask them to write it. I'm going to clean this. Do we need this?
No.
Okay, you guys have got it? Oh, wait. If I just touch this, will that work? No? How do I do the whole board again?
You hold the button, they click it.
I hold the button.
They
What button? Can I just go like this? All right. It's the smart board, but not the smart author. Okay. All right. So now that you know what the core of your story is, which is what I always tell my young writers, that formula is about. That's the core of your story, fiction or non. In this case, it's nonfiction. Here's the core of your story. Now where are you going to begin? You begin at the very top, right? The top, the C. So what would your first sentence be? What would you write? I'd start with Mary Todd. Oh. No, I don't want to. All right. Clear the page. Fine. Okay. Mary Todd. What?
Was born.
Okay. Do you want to start all the way back there?
Oh, no.
Okay.
Oh, attempt to.
Okay. Do you want to start all the way up there? If you're going to tell the story that you just did with your collapse. Yeah.
Mary Todd was a passionate woman.
Okay. Okay.
Could hardly wait for morning.
Rushes over a hill.
Ah, you see, and I love it. Well, you're so, I love it. You're already revising, you smart writers. Okay, so we started with Mary Todd was passionate about learning. And said, so, wait, I could show that. Mary Todd could hardly wait for morning, which now shows that she's passionate. Or?
One fine summer day in 1833.
What's wrong with that? All right, except that I have to erase the board. Okay. All right, I'm going to do this. One, fine. Don't even say there's a program for that. Summer's day. One fine summer's day. In 1833. Mary Todd. I love rush as opposed to was rushing. Why? Because it's active. And if it's active in the first sentence, is it interesting writing? Yes. One day, and fun, fine day, one summer's day in 1833, Mary Todd rushed. Where? To. And this is where I always tell my kids, you have some details. What kind of school? Whose school? Okay. I'm gonna put initials here. To the Shelby Female Academy. Okay. In Lexington. Do we want to pack it all in there or not? That's a writer's choice. I mean, you can decide to do that or not. So you do one fine summer's day in 1833, Mary Todd rushed to the Shelby Female Academy. Okay. Well, we have one fine summer's day.
For her favorite poetry class.
It wasn't what?
For her favorite poetry class.
KK, for her favorite poetry class. Yeah. And that's exactly what you want to do. Just because it's fiction and it's true, we do want to keep them in suspense. Somebody said, who was it? Was it you? I would not. And this is where, just with your facts, you can do, yeah, you can infer, and it's a pretty educated guess. If she's running to school on a summer morning in Lexington, did she have to take the carriage to school? Was it raining?
But wouldn't you want to refer kids back to, primary sources, I guess? Wouldn't that be...
Okay, and they will have... And here's the thing, they will have, because this would have been their research. Okay? So I've started you with the research, and that's a great question. I've started you with the research. But this would have been their research. And absolutely, through the process of finding that information, we would have had them do primary sources, which is what that supporting evidence really is about. If they've got a quote from someone, I'm hoping it was from a primary source. And we would absolutely do that. So they'd go back and they'd look at, like, Elizabeth Humphrey's memoir, which is a primary source written about her cousin's childhood because she lived with her. Yeah. So that would have been a primary source. Absolutely. And you could say to them, do you want to go back and see if this is, was a summer's day, if you could find it. I'm not sure we actually could because we don't know the actual date. So, but I think you can infer, because she was running through the streets, that she wasn't riding that carriage to school that day. Yeah, most people don't elope on a rainy day. Mm-hmm.
Question the fact that it's summertime and school would be out, then you'd have to figure out, well, was a year-round school at that time?
They would, and this is an interesting thing, and that's why I say, when you begin to do this process, that's why I always send them back, we do more research, and you discover your research gaps, or you discover where the questions lie. And what I love about taking a small slice, having them do the primary research, like you talked about, and then writing a story, first finding that core with that secret formula, and then writing the story, is exactly this. All of a sudden, for the first time, I will see young researchers, young writers, actually begin to question the material. So they'll say, well, wait, why was she going to school in the summertime? Was it 1830? Then you say to yourself, go look up. Tell me, Lexington, tell me about it. You say, well, go look up. Take a quick look and see what public education was in 1833. Oh, it's the female academy, so it was a private. Oh, you had summer classes. But that's what's so great, is they will begin to ask the question. I actually did this with sophomores in February. We did this. And it was interesting that every single one of them wrote their story, and they just handed it in. They wrote their stories, and every single one of them didn't even question what a watchman was. And I said, what's a watchman? And they go, Why would you need a watchman? What's the watchman's job? And they went back and questioned it. All of a sudden, they realized that there was no police force in Lexington in 1833. He actually hired a watchman, and the guy actually lit lamps and put them out in the morning, which means that if they had written one fine summer's day, they knew that they would have to go back because the sun would have just been coming up if the watchman was still on duty, yeah, which I was going to get to as we continued to write. But now you blew my secret. But this is exactly what I do with them. And it's hard. You do go back and you begin to question everything you write, which is exactly what I want them to do. You know, just think about this report that one of my youngest son did in high school. It was about Roger Taney. It was like Roger Taney's life. And he actually Googled Roger Taney was born, right? Roger Taney birth, and it comes up, and he actually wrote it down. Roger Taney's major accomplishments, actually wrote it down. Went to school, just wrote it down. But never thought about the actual material. Never tried to put it into context. Never tried to put it into an actual time frame. And that's, I think, what happens sometimes when we give a real broad piece of research. And when we don't ask them to think about it in terms of story. And it is story, even though it's true. Do you have any questions? Sure.
When I read the quote, the watchman, bottom of the watchman quote, since she had been living in a mansion, according to your wear, I assumed it was a private watchman from the house.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they could have assumed that. Yeah, and that would have been that's my mistake. I'm not think absolutely, but that would have been additional too. Then you would have said, well, where was that watchman? You know, if we'd had the thing, I would have said, you get on that internet there and tell me if they had a watchman or not. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She's not a poor girl.
Mm-mm. Absolutely not. It was incredibly, it was the Todds were in this sense, in the fact that she actually studied real things, not embroidery, not piano, not serving tea, but the fact that her father actually sent her to a serious education. Like I said, she actually continued on. She actually had the equivalent of a master's degree. Really made her exceptional in this regard. He really thought that it made for a better wife, a better mother, to be highly educated, and he was too. Did you have a question way in the back?
I had an observation.
Okay.
I thought maybe my sister, because maybe the father might have sent it back then, because maybe he didn't think she was handsome enough to, bring in.
And what I love about that, is that when you get this and you begin to write a story, invariably it forces you to question your material. You begin to say, why? And what it does
all
is...
All the girls were doing embroidery back then.
All the rich girls, that's exactly right. It piques your curiosity, which is exactly what I want the process to be. Because once the curiosity is piqued, all of a sudden you go and find your information and now you own it. History is yours, right? You, all of a sudden, you can't get enough of it, which is what happens. What happens? You're curious. You find the answer, and then you go, eureka. Not only did I find it because I asked it, but I own it. And once you own it, you can't stop it. Yeah, ask me, the historical dork. Once you own it, you can't stop. So exactly. So you go back and you say, well, why did he send her there? Mm-hmm. What was so extraordinary about him? Question after question after question. Uh-huh. And what I've discovered is when I do this with kids, invariably I have to make them stop. Invariably. I just did a whole class where we did, they did F. Scott Fitzgerald. They actually read The Great Gatsby. And instead of writing papers about Gatsby, they decided to do The Roaring Twenties. Well, they decided to do a class book because we went with the small slice. So every single one took a little itty-bitty bit of the 1920s. And at first they started out doing real big projects. Motion pictures in the 1920s. And it was like, wow, that's a big, big subject. Why don't we just do one movie? And so I had this boy doing The Jazz Singer. Well, pretty soon he brought it in because you could get it online, right? So we're all watching The Jazz Singer. And they're trying to figure out why it's a good movie. Who liked this? But it was a great question. Why would anybody like this? What were they watching before? I mean, it was such a great question. Same thing. Women, they wanted to do women's sports. They ended up doing women golfers. One particular woman golfer who turned up was the first woman on Time magazine. Yeah. So it was so great. It was so great.
Now, was this a religious school?
It was not. He was a reverend, but it was not a religious school. Mm-hmm. But another great question. Absolutely.
As a history person, I'm thinking his name was Boyd, and Henry Boyd Beecher. Was he an ancestor of him or something?
And you would ask that. And that's a good question. I didn't even think to ask that myself. Now, email me when you find the answer. Let me know. That would be great. So, and that's the whole process. So as you begin to write it, not only do they end up with a really great story, so the writing is so much more interesting, but they end up questioning the material. And then I even have allowed them to do sidebars, which I know oftentimes they're not allowed to do because they have to stick to their thesis, right? So they can only, but what happens in the research process when you discover something really, really cool? Say you find out that the reverends are related. But how do you put that into your paper? You can't. But it's such a cool fact. And why can't you share that with your reader? You put it in a sidebar. One interesting fact about Reverend Ward. And you title it and you put it in the sidebar. So I'm all about letting them do that too. And what's so fascinating is that they will always end up putting something so... Like I got a great sidebar about the Cotton Club, and I'm not quite sure how it fit with the rest of her essay, but she was so taken with this great story that she wanted to include it, and I'm all powerful, and it was so well written.
As a sidebar to your intended title of Aiken is Vain, last year in one of the local papers, it turned out that a long-lost Lincoln descendant, one of his cousins, Bonnie Lincoln, was a dancer for the New Jersey Nets basketball team.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, this was in the paper like last year.
See, and if it was your paper, that would have been your sidebar. But I did. Sometimes I was like, I should have put it on there. Yeah.
She had a piece of the original log cabin.
Oh, that is so cool.
You
could. You could have set it on fire if you'd had a match. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. So, yeah. And so those sort of facts. And then what I love is that then they all share it. Right? Then they share what they've learned along with those sidebars, and everybody's like, oh, that's so cool, because they think it's so cool, and then I think it's so cool. You know, so.
Something that you just said with the sidebars, with their writing, stick to this. Were you ever told as a child, what was your process? Because often I hear about writers and illustrators who were told by their teachers, stop doodling, you'll never amount to anything. Stop scribbling, you'll never amount to anything. Were you ever given something such as this?
No. I had the, you know what? I had the exact opposite. I really did. I had teachers that were, really, they were gifts. I had a second grade teacher. You know, I just wish I could find them. Miss Johnson, who, I know in the introduction you heard that I like to tell stories and some of them weren't true. And mostly it was because the story in my head went a whole lot faster than the pen in my hand, right? And so I had the second grade teacher who I told stories to, and she knew I was telling stories. And so she said, I tell you what, I'll write them down. So whenever I had a story, I would tell her the story. She would quickly take it down. And then she let me read it with the class, to the class, share it with the class, talk about turn somebody into a writer. And so whenever I had a story, I would tell her I had a story, and she always would, you know, write it down. Except that I got to the point where I often had a story right at math time. And then she'd say, you really must wait, Candy. And then when I was in fifth grade, I had a teacher, Mrs. Van Ballum. By this time, I was writing my stories. I wrote all the time. I gave it to my teacher, Mrs. Van Ballum. I actually wrote her a story for a present because I knew how much she appreciated them, and she was so encouraging. And she took that story, it was like the most amazing thing. She took the story and she sent it to a writing contest. And I didn't know anything about this writing contest as a fifth grader. She sent it to this writing contest and she did not tell me, I guess in case I lost. But I actually won. And it was printed in all the newspapers, and I went to this ceremony, and I have this blue ribbon that I actually, when I go to schools and talk to kids, I still pull it out because I still have it. I'll pull it out and I go, and I won the first place blue ribbon, and they go, it's purple because it's faded and old. But you know, you talk about teachers that really, really, how, you know, boy, they just set my feet on the path. So I never had one that said you couldn't, but I had an awful lot that said you should, you know. So, mm-hmm. Anything else? Yeah. Oh, for nonfiction?
Yeah.
The last thing I want is an anachronism, right? And I never make a supposition about how things are in the 1830s unless I've actually done the research. So a lot of the research that I do early on really is about women's roles in the 1830s, women's roles in the 1840s, women's sphere of influence. I remember it was a huge, huge stuff I read about women, the sphere of influence in the 1840s, and how, who's the Sarah Hale, and what was the magazine? It slipped, and I have a million of my own copies because I actually bought them. What is it? Godey's Home Journal. How much, what effect that actually had on American women and what they thought their role should be as homemaker and sort of moral upholder of the family. And so you end up reading a lot of that before you even begin. And if you think you're making, if you think you can make a safe judgment, that's one thing. But if you're even remotely in doubt, you got to go do the research. That's why I always say to kids, the research process does not end when the writing process begins. You just learn what you don't know as you write.
I have an education addressing the site is about research and everything. You might, maybe because of children's books and they're used for educational purposes many times, that your editors and stuff will have a historian check the facts. But when it comes to, let's say, adult fiction, Clyde Cussler, who writes wonderful adventure books, Raiders of Titanic, I caught two mistakes in his last two books.
Did you?
And I'll tell you exactly what they were. I collect coins and stamps and whatever, and a couple books ago, it takes place in 1906 around the San Francisco earthquake. And he, this actually led to the latest. He has a, somebody gets, this blacksmith creates this like anvil or hook or something, a hook. And he pays the guy, he said a few, he paid him $200 a few gold coins. Well, the highest denomination gold coin was $20. And there's no way a few, if you do the math, comes out to $200. In 1850, they did have some $50 ones that were made by private assayers, but that's wrong. In the book before that, also around the same time, something about money, paper money being minted. About 20 years ago, I think it was John Carson, one of those talk shows, the director of the United States Mint at the time, Donna Polk, made the same mistake about minting paper money. Mm-hmm. Money is printed, and it's not done at the mint, it's at the Bureau of Engraving
minted
in Washington, D.C. The first paper money actually was during the Civil War to fund it. And
I'm thinking a copy editor should know the difference between printed and minted.
I would actually write to Cussler because he sent me some autographed stuff into that, and I'm going to offer to read the book before. And I'm a fast reader, so I'm done four or five.
Why not? I was like, he actually needs an expert to take a look. Yeah.
I don't really want anything for it, and I'm not going to like read the book, have a photographic memory, and go. You know, you do it right in the office there. And he has a collection of antique cars with Rolls Royces and stuff. So, if you want to really do something, you know, pay me back. Is it
with a Rolls Royce. Yeah, yeah.
Drive around the Rolls Royce.
Drive around the Rolls Royce.
I really just want to do this. It's a shame that the books are so popular and everything. And the guy, you know, made mistakes.
And that's every once in a while. I mean, you do find a mistake, it just kicks you right out of that whole world, doesn't it? Yeah. Yeah. I am doing some historical. I mean, I've done picture books, historical fiction, but right now I've got a middle grade that I'm working slowly on, historical fiction. And you know what? I find it really difficult because suddenly I can make up stuff and I go, I don't know. You know, I'm really worried about that.
Can you tell us a little bit about your writing schedule and tips on how you write?
My writing schedule. You know, when I'm home, I'm pretty regimented. So I like to be in my office. I get up, I do my stuff. I like to be in that office by 9 o'clock. And I will work in there till 3 o'clock. That's my schedule. And if I'm not inspired that day, that's too bad. So I sit. So for me, good writing comes from punishment, really. Because I believe in that whole, you know, it's about butt power. That you sit, and if you sit there the first day and you don't come up with anything, you don't write anything, you go back the next day and you sit there, by the third day you'll write out of sheer boredom. You do. And so that's how I do it. Yeah, yeah. And then because I travel so often, if I'm away, like today, I'm away in New York, then I'll pick that day up on Saturday or Sunday. So I only do 5 days a week, so I do have a weekend. Sure. That's nonfiction. It is nonfiction. Mm-hmm. They have not made anything up. It just reads really interesting like fiction, which is what good nonfiction should do.
That's a perfect ending.
It's a perfect ending. You guys got to go. I'll take this if I'm not careful.